Soundwaves Tape Ministry Queensland. We're at the Labrie Conference at the Queensland University in the Abel Smith Lecture Theatre. This is Friday, the 17th of May, and this is cassette number 2 with the guest speaker Richard Winter. His topic, The Challenge of Psychology, Science or Religion. Richard Winter.
The title of my lecture this morning is The Challenge of Psychology, or it could be called Images of Man in Psychology. And in a sense, it is very much a personal odyssey through the world of psychology, in the same way that Jerome's own personal experience was related to you in the last lecture. Many of you probably find yourself, when you're facing non-Christians, or facing a lot of opposition from non-Christians, sometimes ashamed or doubtful about what you believe. You'll be accused of being an irrational, immature person, that somehow Christianity meets a psychological or emotional need, rather than actually being something that is true. And certainly when I started doing psychiatry, some of my Christian friends were very worried about me, but all my non-Christian friends were very happy about me, because they thought this will deal with his Christianity. And that's, in a sense, what I want to share with you in this lecture, is my own understanding, gradually unfolding understanding, of the place of psychology today and how Christianity relates to it. Now, there's another lecture that could go on after it, some of the details, but I'm going to paint in very broad brushstrokes. And those of you who are in the business of psychology or psychiatry will forgive me for oversimplification, but just so that others can get more of a bird's eye view of the whole field. In my own version of Humpty Dumpty, the king's men had never seen an egg before, or whatever Humpty was, and they gathered around at the base of the wall and trying to pick up the pieces and put them together again. Some of them got a few pieces together here, others got a few pieces together there, and eventually, a few of them, the wiser ones, went off to the king and asked him what Humpty had looked like, as he was the only person who had ever seen him before. And then they were able to come back with the king's instructions and start to rebuild the egg. And that is really the theme of my lecture, because in the whole field of psychology and psychiatry, there is a search for truth, a search for what is wrong with man and how can he be put back together again. What is the diagnosis of the problem? What is the prescription for his? What are the prescriptions for his problems? And there are a number of major views in psychiatry that most of you and psychology that most of you will be aware of. Just to put it in diagram form, there are the behaviorists and then the Freudians here on the bottom circles, in terms of their understanding of man, which, in the long run, their view of man leads to a man who is determined, deterministic, a complex machine or animal, with little, if any, freedom of choice or dignity. So there's a sense in which those lead to a dehumanization of man. And on the other hand, in reaction to that, there are the humanistic psychologists and the transpersonal psychologists, who, because of their view of man, in trying to retain the fact that he has some dignity and uniqueness, tend to make him more than he is and to deify him. Now, each of these views, I believe, touches on something of the truth about the nature of man and who we are. But because of their false assumptions and false framework, they take a part of the truth and say that this is all that there is. The tensions and failures in each view of man point to the truth of the biblical image of man, which, as Jerome was saying, adequately answers the many questions that people are asking about who we are and why we are the way we are. It's rather like a key. When you've lost the key of a lock and you have a lot of old keys that you pull out and try each one in the door, and some of them fit a little bit better than the others, and then one will actually turn the lock. But you're trying a lot of different solutions. In a way, these worldviews that come through in psychology, sociology, and so on, are like those different keys trying to fit the lock. Now, the reason, I believe, as a Christian, is because man has abandoned God and his revelation, as the framework or ultimate reference point, he is left only with his own reason to speculate about what man's problems may be. So rather than revelation, he is left with speculation, so that man easily becomes, as I have shown you here in this diagram, deified or dehumanized. Now, it's important because psychology has become incredibly popular, particularly in America. Many, many thousands of people going into counseling and psychology as their major in university. And certain that's expanding to in England, and I would imagine here as well. And one of the reasons, I think, is that psychology has taken over the function of two other major disciplines, namely theology and philosophy. Because the theologians, the academic theologians particularly, are saying, well, we really no longer have the answers to these questions of where man came from and where he's going to. We can speculate about it, and we have symbolic truth in the Bible, and maybe that will give us some clues about what life is about. But really, we don't have any definite answers anymore. And the academic philosophers are saying, well, we don't ask those questions either anymore, of where did man come from, and what's his purpose, and where do values come from. We believe those questions are unanswerable in reasonable terms, and all we're left with is defining words, the linguistic philosophers, and certainly that's been a very powerful school until recently in England. The answers are not out there anymore, they say. You have to discover them somewhere within. So psychology comes along with all the academic respectability of a science and says, well, we have the answers. We'll tell you where you can find how you should live and so on in the realm of sociological statistics and behavioral psychology and so on. They are dealing with the questions of what life is about. Now, at the other end, there is a consumer demand. And one psychiatrist, an English psychiatrist, Anthony Clare, who is not a Christian, wrote this recently. Many of the people flocking to the growth centres, the encounter groups, seem to us to be unhappy, bewildered and disoriented people searching for some philosophical principle, some system of values by which to live. The questions they ask are often the ultimate questions concerning existence, purpose, the meaning of life, happiness, pain or death. We feel that the announced agenda of psychotherapy, or you could say counselling, with its heavy medical, secular and pseudoscientific flavour, insufficiently reflects its frankly religious undertones. So here he is recognising that this is a religious undertaking. So to understand this more clearly, let's go back 100 years or so to the beginning of the science of psychology, of academic psychology. Prior to that time, many of the sciences like astronomy and anatomy and so on had been practiced within a worldview which said God exists and he made the world for us to examine. As James Sire has said, a theistic worldview came with your mother's milk. It was the sort of atmosphere in which people lived, that there was a God who had created us, and science went on within that. As the Enlightenment took hold and people said we don't need God anymore, it was left rather to man on his own to work out, to explore the world, but without any reference to a God who had created it. It's rather like a man on a voyage throwing out a chart and his logbook and saying, I want to discover where I am on my own without any help from anyone else. So there was tremendous pressure for psychology to emulate the other so-called successful sciences, the harder sciences of physics, chemistry and biology, and to be based on that sort of scientific materialistic worldview, where only what you can measure and taste and touch and smell and so on is reality. Anything that you can't measure does not exist. And that's the environment in which Freudianism and behaviorism really began. Now, you can see that that sort of view is in itself a belief. It is an assumption which cannot be proven. And as Bertrand Russell well recognized when he entitled his famous statement of the scientific materialist's creed, A Free Man's Worship. That here was man without God now having to worship something else. But he was free from the restraints of God. So this scientific materialist worldview, empiricist philosophy, influenced academic psychology. And you have two major offshoots developing in parallel of Freudian psychology and behavioristic psychology. And at the same time, you have all the discoveries going on in medicine. Discoveries about the brain, about drugs, and so on through the last few decades. So you have an organic school which is treating man's psychology as a product of his neurons and his biochemistry. Now you notice how all three of these views are essentially deterministic, and I'll go into that in a little more detail. So firstly, Freudianism. Freud was a doctor, first of all, and a neurologist. And he tried to understand the inner world of the mind, not just the conscious mind. He recognized there was more to us than that. And he was really trying to explore in a scientific way what many of the artists had displayed in their plays, their opera, and so on, men like Wagner. Much of his opera, his music, comes out of his dream world, the unconscious. And he knew of its existence long before Freud was even trying to describe it. But Freud now came along and tried to capture it all in terms of such phrases as the laws of omnipotent matter, a project for scientific psychology. He used a lot of hydraulic metaphors and images to describe the mechanisms within the mind. And as most of you know, he elaborated his principle of psychic determinism, that we are essentially determined by our past, by our biology, our genes, and particularly our early childhood environment. And that ultimately man's problems stem from a man's problems, for instance, stem from his passion as a little boy to have a sexual relationship with his mother and to kill his father, the so-called Oedipus complex. Now, you can imagine that this didn't sound very scientific, as it still doesn't very much today. But at the time, it was absolutely outrageous. And it was not till he was age 53 that he actually began to speak about this in public. And at one public meeting, one gentleman got up at the end of the meeting and said, "This is not a matter for a scientific meeting. This is a matter for the police." Now, within Freud's understanding of man, there was a great mixture of what is true and what is false. And that's what I've tried to illustrate in this diagram here, that each of these people touch on something that is true, and yet also, because of their assumptions about the nature of man, go way off away from the truth and produce an awful lot of error as well. So some of the things, for instance, that Freud talked about, the alienation that he talked about within us and within relationships. He had a very profound view of how disintegrated man was. You could say that he was focusing on the fallenness of man, of how broken he is. He talked about the ego, the id, the superego, and the disintegration within. He talked about alienation in relationships. There is truth in that. His defense mechanisms were a helpful model to understand some of the ways in which we defend ourselves against intolerable anxieties. His view of the unconscious was a helpful model again for understanding, and so on. And one could go through a lot of his views and see how they are partial truths within a false framework. Now, on the other hand, because of his scientific materialist background, he was a reductionist. He reduced everything to sex and the problems of sex, and later on bringing conflicts of aggression as well. And he also tended to elevate theory to fact, to say that his view of mankind was true, when in fact it was only a theory, much as many scientists do with the theory of evolution. They say this is the way things are. Science is obvious in this area, rather than accepting that it's just a theory and you have to weigh the evidence. And therefore, because of this, the superstructure of psychoanalysis that he built was rather like a religion. It had its own high priest, and Freud himself, its own initiation rites, and you couldn't really criticize it. You had to believe first and then criticize. And there were some areas that have been proven by research, or certainly there's some quite strong indication that they are true, and other areas that have been completely disproven. And at heart, too, Freud was strongly atheistic and anti-religious. Now, we must recognize that many of his followers and disciples revised his views, and many of them had far more truth in them than Freud had. So don't put every analyst into the Freudian framework, because there are many others. But I haven't got the time to go into those here. So Freud was atheistic, and one of the most striking statements that I've ever come across in his writings is this: I should like to insist that the beginnings of religion, morals, society, and art converge in the Oedipus complex. It constitutes the nucleus of all neuroses. It seems to me a most surprising discovery that the problems of social psychology should prove soluble on the basis of one single concrete point: man's relation to his father. And you can see how close to the truth that really is. He wasn't talking about his heavenly father, obviously, but rather his own earthly father. So that Freud was bent on destroying man's illusion that there is a God out there. He said this is just man's primitive immaturity, that he needs to say that there's a God out there to comfort himself in the face of all the suffering and pain in the world. He said, I regard myself as one of the greatest enemies of religion. Now, he obviously had a religion of his own, but wouldn't have acknowledged it as such. And both he and Nietzsche saw the mechanism of projection, the defense mechanism of projection, coming into operation. So they both said that religion, and here I quote Nietzsche, is invented by weak men who cannot face a universe where there are no ultimate goals, no ultimate truths, and no ultimate meaning. So religion is invented by us to comfort ourselves in the face of our weakness in the universe. It's a projection of our own needs. Now I would like to turn that argument on its head and suggest to you that atheism is invented by proud men, too afraid to acknowledge their own failures and weaknesses, in a world where there are ultimate goals, ultimate truths, and there is ultimate meaning. And that Freud suppressed his own need to deny God, and his whole theory that God is a projection, is in fact is a projection of our own unconscious desires, is in itself a product of his own unconscious need that God shouldn't exist. So we see Freud's diagnosis so close and yet so far from the truth. Here he is acutely aware of man's sense of alienation in the world, his guilt, his broken relationship with his father, the brokenness within himself, and so on. But his response is to shake his fist in the face of God, not even believing there is one, but to shake his fist in the face of God and to resign himself to his fate in the world, believing that only through some sort of stoic resignation can you really cope with life. Let me sum it up very simply again. The assumptions in Freudianism. Really that we arise from impersonal matter through a process of evolution, and that we are now in a state of conflict of instincts, many of them repressed below the surface. We are determined by our genes and our environment, and that the Oedipus complex is really the root of all neurosis. And that our destiny may be affected a little bit by self-understanding and self-analysis. But if we can understand who we are and why we're here a little bit, within the realms of a scientific framework, then we may get some measure of peace. That we may transform our extraordinary unhappiness into ordinary unhappiness. And the word stoic is the word that sums up Freud. He was a stoic in the face of suffering. He had about 16 operations for cancer in the last years of his life, without a word of complaint. And then beyond death, of course, there is oblivion. Now we move on to behaviorism. again rooted in the scientific materialism of the time, running parallel to Freud, but very different. And it is behaviorism which has dominated and still dominates to a large extent the university academic courses in psychology. Partly because science is the science of measuring things. And you can't get into philosophy and vague wonderings about the unconscious and the future of man and so on if you're going to be a scientist. So J.B. Watson in 1913, in an article entitled "Psychology as the Behaviorist Sees It," wrote that he was giving psychology a fresh, clean start as a purely objective, experimental branch of natural science. Concepts like mind, temperament, will, consciousness became irrelevant because you couldn't measure them, therefore they didn't exist. The basic principle being that man is a conditioned animal. You have Pavlov's dogs, Skinner's pigeons, and so on. Man, Watson said, is an animal different from other animals only in the types of behavior that he displays. So that areas of life such as religion, morals, creativity, love of one's children, and so on, are reduced to conditioned reflexes. They have no more significance than that. Now, Skinner's view of behaviorism is more complicated than Watson's, but at root, at heart, is still the same. Skinner said, "I am a radical behaviorist in the sense that I find no place for anything which is mental. Or an inner will as a causal force is a fiction." So let me, in the same way, just summarize the assumptions of behaviorism. Again, like Freud, arising from impersonal matter through a process of evolution, and all is ultimately matter, including mind. There is no spiritual or mental in reality. And man is just a complex biological organism determined by his genes, his chemistry, and his environment. Now, let me distinguish at this point carefully between three different forms of behaviorism. The first is a metaphysical or philosophical behaviorism, such as you have here, which is a belief system about what man ultimately is. A metaphysical or philosophical behaviorism, a set of assumptions about the nature of man. The second is a methodological behaviorism, which is a model which directs much scientific research on human and animal learning and so on. And some people who do that presuppose the metaphysical behaviorism, and others do not. So it's important to, it may be a useful model as long as you recognize its limitations, that in some ways we are like animals, and you can look at some of the likenesses in that model. And then thirdly, applied behaviorism, where one uses the techniques of behavior modification in order, for instance, to help someone with a severe phobia, a process of desensitization, which does not imply that you accept the metaphysical behaviorism at all. Now, just one or two of the problems with behaviorism as we go through this rapid overview. The first major problem is that it rests on certain unprovable assumptions or beliefs about the nature of man. It's built on the philosophical basis of logical positivism, which says that the only thing you can know for certain is that which can be observed or tested publicly. The only thing you can know for certain is that which can be observed or tested publicly. And the problem, of course, with behaviorism is that the theory itself cannot be tested publicly. Secondly, they find it difficult, the behaviorists, to be consistent. There's a sort of double think. If they really believe this, they should really resign themselves to being swept along in the deterministic universe in which we live, determined by our environment, and not believing that any of their choices have any significance at all. So on the one hand they say that, on the other hand they say, talk about using our scientific knowledge to raise ourselves to new heights of kindness, intelligence, and happiness. So that you end up appealing in the metaphysical behaviorism to something like a god outside the system to make the system work. And in Skinner's utopian vision of his behaviorist society, Walden 2, which is written, I think, in the early 60s or late 50s, commonly read by students, he describes his utopian community. He himself is probably the character Frazier, the scientist, who takes one of his visitors, a fellow psychologist Burris, who arrives as a skeptic, up to a high hill from which he can survey the entire community with a telescope. As he oversees Walden 2 through the glass, he comments that not a sparrow falleth. I look on my work and behold it is good. And a little later adds that there is a curious similarity between himself and God, with this difference. God's children are always disappointing him, but my original design took deviations into account and provided automatic corrections. It's rather an improvement on Genesis, isn't it? And then one other comment on the problems. One of the problems with behaviorism is that if we are determined in this way, there is no real basis for responsibility. There is no credit for being kind, and there is no blame for being cruel. Because ultimately, you didn't choose to be that way. But then within behaviorism, you can see that there are partial truths. I've hinted at that as we've gone along. That man is partially biological. He has a likeness to animals. He is partially determined and conditioned by his environment. So that parents know that they use rewards and punishments with their children. Throughout the Bible, God is using rewards and punishments in a sense with the children of Israel and with us. And yet the Bible says that we are much more than that. We do have freedom to choose. So you can see, I hope, that from these two views of Freudianism and behaviorism, taken in their ultimate sense, that man's freedom and dignity and uniqueness is just an illusion. And that ultimately man, therefore, is dehumanized. Now, in reaction to Freud, there came along another well-known gentleman by the name of Carl Jung. And he is a bridge to the other two branches of psychology that I've mentioned. Jung was a great friend. It's said that they talked for 13 hours non-stop when Freud and Jung met for the first time. But gradually they began to fall apart. At first, Freud had seen Jung as his crown prince. Freud often used to talk about himself as Moses and Jung as his Joshua. He hoped that the Swiss Gentile would spread the gospel beyond the Jews. But ultimately, Joshua, that is Jung, became Aaron, leading the people away to the golden calf. This is in Freud's image himself. Because Jung disagreed on the primacy of sex. He said there's much more to man than just sex. He disagreed with Freud's pessimistic view of man. He disagreed with his negative view of the unconscious. Rather than seeing the unconscious as a turmoil of conflicting aggressive and sexual instincts, Jung saw it as a rich storehouse of treasures to be explored. And within you'd find all the answers that you needed in life. And ultimately for Jung, although he uses a lot of God words, and they sound very good, I believe that God for him is actually the collective unconscious of the human race that you can explore through your dreams and your inner life. And in a sense, Freud, Dr. Schaefer has a very helpful way expression. He talks a lot about man being a glorious ruin. He is both glory and ruin after the fall. In a sense, Freud, I think, was exploring something of the ruin, and Jung caught a glimpse of the glory, as do some of the transpersonal psychologists as well. And then finally, Jung disagreed with Freud on his strongly anti-religious views. He believed that the search for meaning was actually one of the most important things for people who were troubled. Now, he was a bridge to what has often been called the third and fourth force in psychology, the first two being the first and second forces. Humanistic psychology now is the third force. And this was a reaction to the loss of the personal, the loss of freedom and dignity in the biological and social determinism of the other two. and also in the organic determinism of those involved in psychiatry, which was running parallel to Freudianism and behaviorism. There was a desire to humanize the behavioral sciences. It was not until the 1950s that this reaction really began to take a grip on the world of psychology. Men like Abraham Maslow in the States, a man from a Jewish background, and he was concerned not just to talk about the ways in which we are like the animals, but rather to look at the ways in which we are unlike the animals. The uniquely human characteristics of self-sacrifice, of shame, of love, of humor, art, beauty, philosophy, and so on. And his book, famous book, was called Towards the Further Reaches of Human Nature. Then there was Carl Rogers, both of them founding fathers of this movement. He, from a Protestant background, went to a liberal theological seminary in the States. And his great emphasis was on helping people to change and grow, of finding the right environment in which they could change and become more truly human, what they were intended to be. His early book on becoming a person was a bestseller. And he has an extraordinary optimism about the nature of man. Even today, he is still incredibly optimistic in the face of Afghanistan and Kampuchea and other parts of the world. He has an amazing optimism. And he, together with some of the existentialists like Viktor Frankl, Rollo May, and others, talking more about the question of meaning being important, brought together a whole smorgasbord of therapies, a combination of existential philosophy, humanistic ideals, Eastern ideas, into encounter groups, transactional analysis, gestalt therapy, bioenergetics. One could go on and on and on with the number of therapies that there are. And the assumptions behind humanistic psychology that come out with nearly all of these people can be summarized in this way. Firstly, again, like the others, evolution from impersonal matter. But an attention here that you will see in a moment, the personal somehow arises from the impersonal. In his present state, man is different from the animals. He is unique. He has dignity. He has freedom. He's not just a conditioned machine. And there is a tension here, trying to transcend the limits of materialism, the determinism of materialism, and yet say that somehow man is free. John Schotter, writing in a university textbook, Images of Man in Psychological Research, writes this: human history, then, is a record of how men have changed as a result of their own efforts and the choices that they have made. It is not a record of how they have evolved naturally. I'm sure if you talk to this man, he would believe in evolution, because there's really nothing else for him to believe in. We are not organisms, but persons. It is not nature, but we ourselves, who are responsible for making and maintaining ourselves as distinct from the beasts and all else that there is. Man is a self-defining animal. So there's this paradox that you can catch in that of determinism and freedom that all of the great philosophies wrestle with throughout the world. A recognition that somehow we are determined and yet also we are free. And where do we find an adequate basis for our freedom, yet recognizing the limits of biology? Then, in relation to our destiny, the humanistic psychologist believes that we have unlimited potential for perfection and goodness. Theodore Roszak, one of the gurus of the counterculture in America in the 60s, says, "We are the unfinished animal, charged with the task of self-perfection that troubles the mind with images of godhood." The entire responsibility of human existence is placed on our shoulders. Then, secondly, in relation to our destiny, we find our meaning and our values to know what is good and right for us in the future from subjective experience. Once you have thrown God out and any objective reality, as Theodore Roszak again says, in the eclipse of God, we have no place to begin but with ourselves, within ourselves. So Rogers writes on Becoming a Person, experience for me is the highest authority. It is to experience that I must return again and again to discover a closer approximation to truth as it is in the process of becoming in me. Neither the Bible nor the prophets, neither Freud nor research, neither the revelations of God nor man can take precedence over my own direct experience. That's where all authority comes from, within. So that, consequently, the obvious life goal is therefore personal awareness, understanding yourself, getting in touch with the inner being, the real you, under the cover of all the things that you've been conditioned to be by society and by your parents and so on. So, and as you do that, follow your feelings, your needs, uncover the real person, you will discover that change is a good thing. Don't be afraid to change. Become who you really are. You will naturally evolve into that. Don't feel guilty. Sin is a dirty word. Be who you are. And you can see how ultimately this leads to a form of self-worship. Now, again, in this view, as with the others, there is a right sense in which there is a desire of humanistic psychology to humanize psychology. After the Freudians and the behaviorists, it's not surprising that man wants to find himself something bigger than that. He is not here reduced to an animal or a machine. Rather, he is something more. Often scientists tend to say man is nothing but this, that, or the other. Here they are saying, no, man is something more. He is unique, he is worthwhile, he has dignity, he has freedom. Now, they would claim that we find our values from within. There are no absolute values. And yet they too recognize a tension here that they live in. John Rowan, in a book called Ordinary Ecstasy, writes, on the one hand, humanistic psychology is very open and receptive, opposed to laying trips on people, in other words, do your own thing. On the other hand, it is seen as very intrusive and aggressive, and very heavily laden with values that it is busy pushing. And sure enough, it is busily pushing them in schools, universities, wherever, in the name of perhaps a neutral science. It is a vehicle of secular humanism. But you can see again how it is a partial truth, a desire for uniqueness and dignity, an aspiration, but it's really a true aspiration that reflects something of the reality of who we are as human beings, and yet it is caught in a false framework. Now, many of the people who set off on this journey of self-awareness in the early 60s, as the years have gone by, have found themselves left with a lot of problems. They didn't find that beautiful person that they hoped for inside. They didn't find the harmonious relationships with other people. The world didn't seem to be getting better. No, in fact, it seems to be getting worse. They found that they themselves felt inadequate to deal with the problems of life, too small to bear the burden of being their own God. And so there's a gradual shift to another whole worldview, a move to what many have called transpersonal psychology. And here there is a convergence of humanistic, existential, Eastern and occult ideas. Many varieties. You find in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology that it has moved from being just talking about self-awareness and personal awareness. In the last few years, it has turned into a journal of Eastern mysticism. Many of the articles are about meditation and Eastern philosophical ideas. It is a move beyond personal awareness, where they have not found the answers, to an awareness of the oneness of reality. Oscar Icazo, who started the Eureka Institute, Psychotherapy Institute in New York, is a good example of this. He trained in Zen, Shamanism, Buddhism, Confucianism, combined with Western psychology, Christian terminology, so on. He dabbled in all of these things and brought it together into a form of therapy called Eureka therapy. And he says, when we turn away from our primal perfection, our completeness, our unity with the world and God, we create the illusion that we need something exterior to ourselves for our completion. Man can find no real happiness until desire is extinguished, and he returns to his essence, that is, until he reaches what Buddhism calls nirvana, or the void. There is no peace short of being within the divine consciousness. And many of the techniques of psychotherapy and meditation and so on are techniques of helping you to become aware of your true oneness with reality. Fritjof Capra, and I would strongly recommend his books, the Tao or the Tao of Physics, T-A-O of Physics, and The Turning Point, writes of this cultural revolution, as he sees it, a whole new way of seeing that is taking over in all disciplines. It's not just psychology. It's not just the Hare Krishna people who dance in the streets. It's a much more deeper, fundamental shift in the way people see reality. He says, in Chinese culture, yin and yang have never been associated with moral values. What is good is not yin or yang, but the dynamic balance between the two. What is bad or harmful is imbalance. So that what you have to learn to do in these various techniques is to move with nature. Don't resist nature. Be who you are. Change with the ebb and flow. Change, he says, does not occur as a consequence of some force, but is a natural tendency innate in all things and situations. And therefore, if you resist change, in whatever form it occurs, then you will become unhealthy and unwhole and incomplete. If you flow with change, tune in to reality, to nature, then you will be who you were intended to be, one with reality. The word Tao or Dao, as I'm sure many of you know, in the Chinese means the way to truth about reality. So let me summarize, as I have done with the others. This worldview. Again, I would say that there are all sorts of varieties within this worldview, but these are some of the essential points. That ultimate reality, in contrast to the others, is from impersonal mind or spirit. So it's what one would call a monistic view. The others are a materialistic monism, that all is matter ultimately. This is now all is spirit or mind. That there is an essential unity of all things, and man's task is to recognize that and to live in it through enlightenment. And that as you learn to flow with reality, then you may have psychic power available to you, an energy which was not available before. And this is where this worldview merges now with the occult. That a number of people who have got into this also are into spiritualism and communicating with spirits and achieving a psychic power over other people. But it's not pure humanistic psychology by any means. And man's destiny is to be absorbed into the greater self, spelt with a capital S, as the Hindus call it. Or a cycle of reincarnation, an ever onward cycle. That if you do good things, then you will be reincarnated as someone superior in the next life. If you are a woman and you behave well in this life, you will be reincarnated as a man, and so on, upwards. Eventually reaching a point of nirvana, of release from this samsara, the cycle of life and death. So that the solution to man's problems is to redefine reality. Not to actually confront reality and nature and resist it, but to redefine it and say, well, now I see the way it really is, and the way it really is the way it ought to be. Now, in psychology, there are many attempts to blend the humanistic psychology and the transpersonal. So very few people are consistent when you talk to them with these assumptions. They may slide from one to the other. As one friend was saying the other day, it's rather like a lily trotter bird. When you talk to them when they're standing on one leaf, they quickly hop to the next leaf when that one starts to sink. And I hope you can see that through these worldviews, if you reduce everything to reason, to science, to a deterministic view of man, then man becomes dehumanized. On the other hand, if you reduce everything to subjective experience and spirit and mind, then man becomes deified. He is more than he really was intended to be. Now, there is a third reaction to this dehumanizing of man, which is very common in Europe, which I just want to mention very briefly. One psychologist writing in Radical Perspectives in Psychiatry, a series of little university textbooks, Nick Heather, says that he admits that psychology deals with values. It's not a neutral science. And he says, we must decide what is best for man. We, the psychologists, the experts, must decide what is best for man. And then he goes on, in the last few pages of his book, he analyzes psychology in very much the same way as I have, right the way through. The last few pages is a little twist at the end, where he says, humanistic psychology is bourgeois and middle class. It's not dealing with the root problems, which, of course, are political and economic. It's not man's heart that is the problem, or his perception of reality. No, it's his political and economic situation, which needs to be changed. And therefore, we need to move towards a revolution, a classless society, and eventually a Marxist millennium, where man will be truly free to perfect himself. And that view in psychology and sociology is very powerful, and increasingly powerful, in most of the universities in the world. So I would suggest to you from this that only Christianity adequately answers the aspirations and the questions that we come up with in the field of psychology. It only adequately explains the glory and the ruin. It gives some sort of framework for the tension between freedom and determinism. And demonstrates that the principles God has given are true. And all these other views are partial truths within a false framework, which could be seen in our own contemporary culture as forms of idolatry. Rather than man being made in God's image, now God is made in man's image. And he worships, as Paul says in Romans, he exchanges the truth of God for a lie and worships and serves the creature rather than the Creator. He worships a part of reality rather than the whole. So therefore, another reaction to these questions that we've been struggling with, of what is the nature of man and so on, surely is return again to the revelation that God has given us in the world around us, in creation, in man himself, in the Bible, and in Christ. A personal revelation in Christ. And within that framework of revelation, reason and experience find their proper place. And we can begin to sort out what is true and what is false. Let me summarize in the same way that a Christian psychology must be based on a Christian worldview and a view of man. But in contrast to the others, that God has revealed to us, shown us, that he has created us, that he is a personal God who makes us in his image for a relationship with him. That the universe is not just material or immaterial, it is both. That man is not just mind or body, but he is both. That he is made to live in a relationship with his maker. And because we understand something of the origins, and also understand something of the destiny, that God is going to make us again perfect one day when we are with him in glory, we understand then the relevance of the present state that we are in, that there was a fall, that man disobeyed God, and there was alienation at every level of his existence, which is what many of the psychologists, the Freudians and others, are pointing to, a disintegration within man. Alienation between man and God, man and himself, man and woman, man and nature. And that only through God's plan of redemption, his desire that we should be made perfect again, can man find truly who he is. So that Paul says in Romans, the whole creation groans, waiting for its redemption. That we live in an abnormal situation now, which will one day be made the way God intended it to be. That we are being changed, as Paul says, into his image, little by little. Those who have come to him through Christ are being changed into his image. And therefore, in the light of this, as a framework for psychology, then comes the task for Christians in that field to map out the areas of common ground between humanistic psychology and Christianity, between Freudian views of man and Christian views, to map out the areas of common ground and difference, both in the area of what they believe man to be, also in the area of aims and goals of what you're trying to push him towards, and thirdly, in the area of technique, in terms of the sort of techniques one might use in helping somebody in psychotherapy or counseling. So that, in a sense, is the task, to recognize that science is actually can only grasp a very small part of the reality of who we are. It is not neutral. It is limited. And there are many other ways of knowing who people are and discovering about them. So scientists must be very careful because of the danger of reducing everything to nothing but. Rather, we should always remember that man is something more. So in the field of psychology, we need not be defensive or apologetic. We are going to find areas of common ground where we can work alongside non-Christians. Their views are not all rubbish and a waste of time. There will be common ground, and yet also we must not be afraid to stand up when the big questions, the philosophical questions, emerge, to say, well, yes, we have thought about that, and there are other alternatives to the views that you are putting forward. We must be humble in saying there are some things we do not fully understand about man. But rather it is like the key that I mentioned at the beginning, or the glove that Jerome mentioned, fitting the hand, that the Christian view fits reality far better than any of the other views. And from it we can develop a science that will do justice to every level of man's being. Let me finish with a quote from a man called William Kilpatrick, who himself has been on a pilgrimage through the whole humanistic psychology movement, looking for truth, looking for himself, and not finding it there, and coming out the other end very disillusioned with what it had to teach him, and then eventually turning back to Christianity that he had known in his childhood, and finding there many of the answers to his problems. He writes this: Auguste Comte, who is generally credited as the founder of the religion of humanism, wanted to establish new humanist feast days to replace the Christian ones, which he was sure would die out. G.K. Chesterton, the great English apologist, professed disappointment that none were forthcoming. He would be glad, he said, for an excuse for another celebration, and could easily imagine myself with the greatest enthusiasm lighting a bonfire on Darwin Day. But of course, Comte and his followers failed in their efforts. They have not, chided Chesterton, set up a single new trophy or ensign for the world's merriment to rally to. They have not given a name or a new occasion of gaiety. One does not, as he observed, hang up his stocking on the eve of the birthday of Victor Hugo, or sing carols descriptive of the infancy of Ibsen outside people's doors in the snow. Were Chesterton alive today, I think he might profess the same mock disappointment with the religion of psychology. Whatever its other virtues, and despite its claim to psychic liberation, psychology fails somehow to bring out our festive nature. We do not, if I might extend Chesterton's analogy, exchange presents or greeting cards on the birthday of Dr. Freud, or dance in a circle on the anniversary of his discovery of the unconscious. We do not have solemn processions or sing hymns on Jung Day, though Jung would certainly have approved. The memory of Pavlov does not put a spring in our step, nor do we let loose streamers or set off firecrackers in commemoration of Stimulus Response Day. We do not eat roast turkey or pass the punch bowl on the feast day of Abraham Maslow, nor do we decorate eggs and hunt for them on Human Potential Day. Despite our faith in the theology of psychology, we do not find much cause for rejoicing in it. We do not do so today, and it seems safe to say but 2,000 years hence, we still will not. Thank you. Now, I guess we have some time for questions. How long have we got, Peter? Till 5:30, is that right? Mm-hmm. Any questions that you want to... As I said in my lecture, there's a whole other lecture which one could go on to, which I'm sure those of you in the business of psychology would be interested in exploring, maybe talking individually with me, in terms of how do you relate these things, if you're in the business. Can everyone hear? Is it possible for you to come down to one of these? Do you mind? Can we handle those, Peter? Sorry to make it so formal.
I was just saying that I'm from San Francisco, and so therefore most of my friends and acquaintances have been involved in transpersonal psychology for years, and they all came from Christian or Jewish backgrounds, and so they believe in God, and now they've found their expression for God in either Hinduism, Buddhism, Sufism, or something like that. And when I try to speak to them as a Christian, they say, well, we all have a path to God, and that's your path, and all paths can only lead to the one God. So it's not as if they're not morally searching people. It's not as if they don't lead moral lives, and as a matter of fact, they feel they're more moral than Christians and more spiritual. What can I say to them when I speak about grace and salvation? They reduce that to reincarnation and all of those arguments which you've heard. I don't know what to really say to them. 2 minutes.
That's a lecture in its own right. Wim, again, will, as Jerome mentioned, will be dealing with the whole subject of Eastern mysticism, and if you have that many friends, I would go along to that workshop later on. But I think you're right. It's right. I think one of the problems is probably the Christianity that they knew was not a very helpful form of Christianity. It's often a very narrow, sometimes very just experiential Christianity that doesn't deal, that is another experience. So you can have your experience with the Guru Maharaji or whoever it is, and you'll have the same experience as the Jesus people. So what's the difference? Right? Now, we're talking about it here at a deeper level on that and saying, well, how does our experience of the world relate to what we find that God has revealed to us in Scripture, and so on? How does our experience fit that reality? Does the Bible have answers to reality that we experience that are, in a sense, that fit better than the answers of Eastern mysticism, where transpersonal psychology really finds its root? So that when you start talking with these people and you start questioning, well, that, for instance, the basis of morality, for instance, one example, how do you know what is good and bad? And ultimately for them, good and bad are all part of the same thing. Yes, they may try to live moral lives in order to be reincarnated a bit higher up, but that is, in a sense, a lower form of Hinduism, a more personal form of Hinduism. But ultimate reality, when you get there in the end and become truly enlightened beyond that, is actually one. Everything is one. So that evil is the other face of God, right? So you have no ultimate basis for saying what is really, this is wrong and this is right, and they are different. And that a God who is holy and personal cannot touch something which is evil. It's not a part of him. Okay? In the area of how do you know what reality is? How do you know you're not just dreaming? You know? Maybe you're just sitting there as a dream. You're dreaming. You're sitting here in my lecture and I'm dreaming. I'm giving it to you. But there isn't a sense of reality. If in an ultimate reality, as they would say, there are no distinctions ultimately between mind and matter, that all is matter, well, you tell them to go and walk out in front of a bus. You know, they will discover that there's a distinction between mind and matter there, because they will experience it. Now, some of them, most of them would just laugh at you and say that's stupid. You know, but when you get down to the philosophical assumptions, which many of them have never actually thought about in very great detail, and start to say, well, can I actually live that way? You come into tensions, right? In the same way, Dr. Schaefer used to use an illustration of people being stretched on an elastic band. Now, if you try to live out as a behaviorist that reality of being determined, then what does it mean to love your wife? You know, you're just a mechanical determined by the past. There's no significance in you loving her. She's a machine too. If you try and live out the existence that all is mind and all is spirit, and that ultimately there are no differences between good and evil and so on, and between this and that, distinctions in reality. Our distinctions are the fact that we tend to think too much. If you try and live that way, you don't last long. So the more you stretch out on your assumptions and try to live consistently in another worldview, the more tension there is on that rubber band. You see what I mean? Away from the reality in which I believe God has created us. Okay? Well, they have totally misunderstood evil in the Christian framework. In the sense of that there are Christians who misunderstand and think that evil, that God sent it in order to bring about some great purpose. It's rather that evil came into the world as a result of man's sin and rebellion against God. He said, I want to do what I want and go my way. And for that reason, evil came into the world, and God, in His grace, has said, I will make a way back to myself for man and bring good out of evil, but He never actually sent it or intended. He never intended death in the world. That wasn't His plan, but He is redeeming it. You see? Maybe we could pursue it, if you want, to talk about it personally, because it's a big issue. And the other problem with it is that when you start talking about God and Christ, for them, the words mean something completely different. And when you try and define words, then ultimately they would say, well, you can't define words. So how do you talk? I remember talking to a Buddhist, we have a Buddhist community quite near ours in England. And we also have a community to worship the spirit of a Red Indian chief. It's a healing community. So we're surrounded by these things in the heart of English countryside. And I was talking to him about this, about this Buddhist. He was saying, theoretically, I should lose all desire, you know, and withdraw from my desire, and then I would be one with all that is. So I said to him, well, does that mean that if you had a wife, say, or if my wife died, I shouldn't cry about it? I shouldn't be upset, that it really is of no significance? And then he just laughed. That wasn't in the area of the rational that you could talk about. Because theoretically, he should say, you shouldn't be so attached to anything in that way that it would hurt. But you can't talk about that. That's an irrational, in a sense, response, that you have to retreat into the tension is released by laughing. Do you see what I'm saying? And often you get to a point where you cannot teach, where you cannot talk, and you have to demonstrate by your life that there is a different sort of existence. Yeah. Can you speak loud?
I'm very interested in your mentioning of Marxist psychology as a movement in Europe. Is there such a thing as Marxist psychology? And I was actually talking to a friend from mainland China last night who was talking about having a personality that the state wants you to have and giving your child up to the state. My reaction was, yeah. And he said, that's exactly what you do with God. God, in the Christian religion, has the same function as the state in communist China. So,
yeah, it's a good question. Yes, there's a sense that each worldview, each belief system about the nature of man defines who man really is and tries to make him into that sort of man. Now, what we are saying, what I would say as a Christian, is that in believing in God, believing that God created us, He has shown us the best way for us to live. And in the boundaries of that, the framework of what he has shown us, then we will be truly free to be who we are, with dignity and freedom and so on, in a relationship with him. That is the definition of freedom, true freedom. Okay? Now the Marxist would say, no, true freedom is in this box over here, which is defined by the state, so that in a sense their view of the healthy man, the total person, true humanity, is what the state says you shall be. And as you will discover in some of the other lectures, Udo and Jerem and others will be talking about that, where actually the individual does not matter at all, ultimately. It's the state that matters. So for the sake of the health of the state, of the nation, the future of the people, individuals will be sacrificed. If they dare to raise their head above the crowd of the masses and say, I object, that's it. I mean, that's putting it very starkly. But essentially, that's what it is about. And there's a sense in which that sort of loss of individualism is true in transpersonal psychology, because ultimately, if all is mind and spirit, and you are to blend with that, your individuality disappears. Now, they may try and live as individuals with significance and freedom, but if they're true to the sort of philosophy of it, they should move beyond that into oneness of everything. Whereas the Christian is saying, no, God has created us as really important, with incredible value, as unique, with dignity, for a relationship with him. We're not just to blend with the masses, but each person's individuality is important, so that you don't have to all sit here and wear the same clothes in lecture as students, or as you might have to in Peking. That speaks something of the dignity that has come from a Christian view of reality and of nature. Do you see what I'm saying? Now, as for formulating a specific psychology, I mean, I find it interesting that psychiatry in the Soviet Union is dominated by behaviorists and the organic school. There's very little psychotherapy, because psychotherapy is doing what the state tells you to do. Okay? So you shouldn't need that. But what you do need is better conditioning or getting your biology sorted out, because ultimately the view of man is one of determinism. Okay. Whereas in the West, because we have a view which stems from a Christian view of man, we do recognize man's determinism, but also his freedom and uniqueness. Any other? Yes.
Excuse me for staying on the rock for a second. In your daily work as a Christian psychiatrist, would you say that you ever have any pain you get to? What I'm trying to say is that taking an individual case of treatment, possibly at that early, in the early stages, it's not appropriate or effective to talk gossip.
Right.
You do have to use some of the other techniques,
Not right. That's really what I was trying to get across. I'm sorry if I haven't made it clear enough. Is the fact that there are truths there which one can use. There are insights of Freud, of Jung. For instance, in talking to people about, I don't do it all the time by any means, but talking about their dreams. Some of Jung's ideas are actually quite helpful. His stress on the fact that man's search for meaning is very important. You know, but he, in all his writings, and he's spread an incredible breadth of knowledge in his volumes and volumes, he is touching in many places on the truth, and one can acknowledge that and say, well, this is true to Christianity. It's interesting, at the end of his life, dear old Jung, and I have a great, very soft spot for him, because I think he was in some ways a very humble man, and yet he couldn't face the reality, I think, of a personal God before whom he needed to bow. The end of his life, in his biography, he ends up, after all this searching for truth, I really know nothing more. Which is, in a sense, a sad epitaph. That he knew lots of knowledge, just as many people do today. He had tons of knowledge, but no real wisdom, no understanding of what man was about. And yet, within that, all his knowledge, there are a lot of things that might be helpful. And one would have to go through and look at each volume and say, well, look, where is this touching the truth, and where is it moving away? He also, interestingly too, which didn't help at all, as many of you know, his mother was a medium, or at least his mother had very occult influence in her life, and he did his first thesis on a medium and was very interested in the whole occult area, and there's some very weird experiences that he had, which I think only added to the confusion for him. Any others? Yes. Do they really believe everything? I mean, what does that mean? I'm not sure what they're saying. But it's usually that I can't believe anything. You know, I've been taught so much and had so many conflicting views that I'm now cynical about really knowing anything for sure at all. That's the much more common view, certainly in England. Maybe the Australians are more optimistic. I would just say, I mean, I think you all have to say with these folk, you know, what do you really mean by that? Do you mean that you believe that black is white? That good is evil? You know, drawing out some distinctions. Do they really believe that there are no significant distinctions? Can you actually believe, for instance, Hinduism or Buddhism and Christianity? Are they actually ultimately saying the same thing? Well, if you get down to it, if words mean anything, they are not saying the same thing at all. And that's where you have to push people, I think. And this is where Schaefer talks a lot about it. Wim may be talking about it a bit later on. But gently, you have to push people, not be on the defensive yourself, but rather saying, well, what do you mean by that? Pushing them, exploring what they base their ideas on. What do they actually believe in life? What is the? Where is the ultimate point beyond which they will not go?
It comes from the Hegelian dialect where A is non-A.
Right.
Could you probably explain on a perspective on the dialect, on that A was non-A?
You'll have to get one of my philosopher friends, like Wim, to help you more on that. But it is this. You know, ultimately, it comes down to that. Where if you don't believe there are any true distinctions, that's really what I've been trying to say, is based on that, then you have problems talking at all. Right? You have to accept there are some distinctions, and then you have to work, well, what are those? How can we know what those distinctions are? How can we have meaningful communication at all? If you believe anything, then you can't. Yeah, one last question and then we'll stop. I'm only hearing part of it. Are you saying that as people commit themselves to certain ideas on a rational basis and get burned by that, in other words, go off in the wrong direction, they get hurt and then become cynical? Is that?
Well, I'm suggesting that it's the basis, maybe the basis for a lot of the people who find it hard to discuss anything rationally.
Yeah.
The problem, basically, yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a lot of why we see so much cynicism around us, is that people really are frightened of thinking because it hasn't got them anywhere very often. And therefore, it's better just to be and to live and to blend with what is, to flow with whatever's going. Immediately you stand up and start saying something's right and something's wrong, there's a risk that you may be wrong yourself and go off into some weird thing. And many of the young people who come to Le Brie have tried all sorts of things, you know, and have ended up like this. And not only non-Christians, but Christians too, have tried all the more extreme branches of Christianity and been burned by that. And now they want to know, well, how can I know what the Bible says? You know, this person says it says this, this person says it says this. Where do I go? And they become very skeptical and profoundly afraid of even thinking at all. We'll deal with more of those questions, though, I think, in later lectures. So I think we should stop now and let you get some lunch. Thank you.
Could I make some announcements? You can see, hopefully, where the seminars are, which begin at 1:30. The room numbers are on the list outside. If you would be there on time, so that they can begin without any delay, they will go until 3 o'clock. Yeah, if you wish lunch, the refectories are open. And could I ask you also that if you see people who are by themselves or people that may need someone to sit and talk with, or if you can capture one of the speakers, have lunch with them so that you continue this conversation, which is by no means complete, during the breaks and lunch times. So we reconvene at the seminars at 1:30. The Forgan Smith building is the ground floor level of the sandstone main block building just across the road here. You'll find the numbers if you walk in one of the entrances. Oh, sorry, and 31, 32, 39, and 72, and 72 is upstairs. Thank you. Thank you.